thank you. And that was quite riveting. And the most riveting thing of all, to encounter a journalist who makes a confession of a mistake, which must be, if not actually, a first close to it. I want to ask a few questions. I know a lot of you will want to ask Ian questions as well, but just if I could start the ball rolling with a couple of my own. I mean, I was really intrigued what you said about data and the need for journalists to find data and analyse data. And I see that as an increasing trend within journalism. I know, for instance, locally, we've got The Detail, you know, which has won prizes for its data analysis. And yet it seems to me that that's the one thing that your average journalist is pretty scared of and walks away from. And that even in the tradition of journalism, you know, when we were taught how to write for newspapers and how to write scripts for TV and radio, you would never, you would never write 37.5% of such and such. You would say, well, just over a third. journalism seemed to be a vocabulary fudging data rather than for being precise on it. So can you tell us more about just how important you think it is for journalists to have the skills for reading data and what stories we might be getting at that we're not getting at?
Well, I think it's absolutely invaluable. I was very struck when I started the Bureau how I was desperate to get people who really had numerous skills. And I found that everyone sent me their CV had done English or history or geography or languages at university, but none had done maths or physics or sciences, really, or very few had. The ones who had, I would always get in and speak to them, and it made me realise two things. One is that actually data, there's two forms of data. There's understanding statistical data, and a lot of people get things wrong. Like, I read this tweet yesterday by Arianna Huffington. She said that meditation decreases mortality by 23%, and I was like, "Well, we all die. You can't decrease mortality. There is an end game for all of us." But people didn't understand the statistical element of that. But but the thing that I think often people didn't really get the grasp on was how to read balance sheets. I think huge amounts of sins in the world, for want of a better word, are covered up by the banality of corporations. They can hide their ugly little mines in the southern Philippines or their nefarious activities of dumping toxic waste into rivers by just pushing out endlessly dull balance sheets and annual reports. And your average journalist, unfortunately now, can't pick up a balance sheet and read it. I taught myself how to. But some of the best journalists I've worked with have been ex-accountants. So, for instance, I once went out to Vodafone's head offices in Switzerland. And what they had done, even though Vodafone has no mobile presence in Switzerland, they have a very, very lucrative head office, or Swiss office. And what they do is they take their profits from Britain, they push it through Luxembourg, who then push it to Switzerland, back to Luxembourg, back to Britain. And by doing so, they denude the UK of something in the region of £950 million worth of taxes a year. So I went to interview this this effective Vodafone employee, secretly filming him in Switzerland. I pretended I was a corrupt middleman between a Chinese telecoms company and wanted to do the same trick. And he gleefully showed me the offices of Vodafone, which was a broom cupboard. This broom cupboard making £950 million a year profit. So really it's about trying to understand that methodological approaches. And there are very few investigative journalists, and there are very, very, very many accountants and auditors who believe they're acting as small cogs in a wheel. They don't see the bigger wheel. They don't think that what they do is a problem. Most people don't go home and go, you know what, I denude the government of four hospitals. What they think of is, I make a living for my children. And I think investigative journalists have to say, well, yeah, I understand that this is your job, but sometimes we have to say, should I be doing this job?
Yeah. You got into investigative journalism in the 1990s, late 90s, I'm guessing, at a time when there was a proliferation of independent production companies around London and so on. Which was the one that you took in, by the way?
Brooke Lappin.
Sorry? Brooke Lappin, yeah. I mean, That again is part of the evolution of journalism from a time when it was something learned through an apprenticeship to something learned through university and MA degrees, to a stage where you could really just turn up at the door of one of these companies with an idea. Am I right? You know?
Very much so. Yeah. And I think it's kind of evolved even further from now. Is that certainly, there's a guy called Brown Moses who basically just set up a blog that was charting the use of explosive weapons in Syria. And he's gone from, I think he was an NHS auditor beforehand, to he was made redundant. He did this, and now he's a full-time arms investigative journalist.
But are there dangers in that casualization of journalism?
Well, I think there definitely is, and we're seeing it even now, I think, coming out of Gaza, in the sense that anybody with a mobile phone can claim that they can take pictures. And what we're seeing is a proliferation of images that are actually out of Syria, but people are tweeting them that they're out of Gaza, and there's huge dangers of not having accuracy. And I think that the danger of the democratization, so to speak, of journalism, I mean, there's many, many benefits of it, but the one danger is about whether people may be using it for propaganda purposes. And that's why I did an expose of PR companies, because there are PR... Bell Pottinger, who I did a big expose on, actually has two fake people on it that don't exist, but they have Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts, and they proliferate information on comment boxes on the internet to try to disrupt the conventional narrative.
Yeah. Can I maybe just see if there's any hands on to shoot up and maybe a question over here?
Thank you very much, sir.
Can you introduce yourself, by the way?
My name is Sean McKeown, unemployed pensioner.
You can't be both.
Listen, watch me. You touched on it, very interesting, on what effect, consequences, if you like, all this body of some excellent work, right? Does it really make a difference? Now, don't get me wrong, I don't want to insult you by saying it's a waste of time. But have you ever sat down, say, some Sunday afternoon with a glass of wine and a spiff for the MS, right? I sort of say to yourself, well, yes, that did make a difference. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the other question is, when did you first know about the activities of Murdoch's journalists?
The issue of does it make an impact? I mean, I think, whilst probably my talk was immodest and it was all about me.
You did give us the statistics on the reduction in drone attacks, and you did try to take some credit for that.
I think it was part of it. I think you are just one of many. And I've always felt certainly my role in the Bureau and currently, Action on Violence, is I try to encourage something to become news, to become an agenda, to get talked about more and more. And I think there comes a tipping point that you could be singing lonely in the dark and nobody listens to you for years and years on end. And then all of a sudden, you hit a zeitgeist. And it's that hitting of a zeitgeist. So I thought I'd hit it with PR and lobbying, because there was a commission set up to look at lobby. There was an attempt to create a register. But the lobby is so strong that it sucked that out. And that is I think I've lost that fight, because I don't have the voice of the Bureau to re-engage with it. But I did think I won the fight but I think I did have an impact with drones. So, you win some, you lose some. With regard to Murdoch, I know lots of people who work for the Murdoch print and press, who are admirable, good, solid journalists. I mean, the Times produces really good investigative journalists. The trouble is, of course, there's a few bad apples who have soured everything. Interestingly, 15 years ago, I was hired by the BBC to do a drama on the Daily Mail hacking and tapping into people's phones. The trouble is, we couldn't find the substantial evidence. I got lots of anecdotal evidence, but I got nothing enough to turn this into a BBC drama, and I was working with a very leading BBC documentary maker. So this was long before the hacking thing became a scandal with Murdoch, because the Daily Mail was up to it. And that's why the Daily Mail has been rather quiet in this whole thing, because they know that they've got skeletons in their closet.
Another question back here. Sorry.
I just want to know, do you ever engage with politicians who might one day, you know, be in a position to do something about the tax laws or the laws on selling arms and ammunition? You know, I would see that as an important part of your work.
Well, he should be lobbying, you mean?
Well, yeah.
Well, I did
sorry,
give...
Well, in legal elections, do politicians ever ask you to meet you privately to talk about...
Yeah, well, strangely, I went to... I gave a talk about the proliferation of British manufactured goods that end up helping IED materials and other explosive weapon materials. And certainly we can trace some of the weapons being used in Gaza back to UK companies. And I gave this presentation to the Parliamentary Working Group on Explosive Weapons, and there was one MP turned up. So, I mean, there's a real challenge. I think the best-meaning MPs just have so much on their plate, and the worst MPs don't engage at all. So I lobby in a kind of a low-level way like that. But again, when it comes to lobbying, I mean, this is what I've got a big issue with lobbying is, I'm more than happy to be transparent when I'm lobbying. It's the private dinners that I can't afford as a charity. That's the concern. It's who's BAE Systems offering some MP further down the road a consultancy job of £200,000 a year? I mean, I can't. I can just offer him his conscience.
Yes? Sorry. Yeah.
Hi. My name's Anne Cavill, and I work for the Patman Lincoln Centre. Right. We've recently discovered documents that show that the British knew they were arming the UBF and the UDA throughout the conflict here. What you said about the guns that went lost, you said, in Iraq, could you tell us a bit more about that? Were they lost? Were they given? Were they supplied? How did that come about?
Well, there's a big inquiry happening, and it's not just actually happened in Iraq. There's been a recent report of even more. 190,000 happened in Iraq. They think they've lost 740,000 in Afghanistan of small arms, including the oversupply of 84,000 AK-47s to an army where they were telling everyone to go and buy NATO weapons, not AK-47s. So they gave incredible numbers of guns. I think there's two things. I think there's elements of corruption and a kind of a catch-22 in a book type way that some quartermaster is getting backhanders and there's lots of sort of contracts being met. Huge amounts of money being thrown at all of these security issues. In terms of the US military going in and deliberately arming opposition groups, I don't think that that probably is the case, but certainly I think that there's abject failures of responsibility. And when I go back to the US Department of Defense and say, you've lost now something in the region of 1 million guns in Iraq and Afghanistan, what's your response? Their response is, these are sovereign states, it's their responsibility, not ours. I say, but you invaded their countries. I mean, surely you have a responsibility. And then they don't answer your email.
Are the guns trackable in a sense? I mean, presumably eventually guns will be found beside bodies of ISIS fighters and so on, and with serial numbers on them. And
well, this is the inherent problem, but certainly in Syria at the moment, is that, I mean, I can't really, I mean, I can't go there. I mean, I've gone to the borderlands, but there are places where, I mean, the closest to the most terrifying I've ever had it was when I was in Somalia. We knew that every single group there wanted to kill a white person simply to make a statement. I mean, there is places now as I personally cannot go. So there are some investigations that will come out over time, but they can't be found immediately.
If I can email you our evidence, would you email me yours?
Absolutely, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about safety, actually, about yourself and also that of your subjects. That's the first part of the question. Have there been cases when, you know, by speaking to you, people have got into danger? And also I wanted to ask you, what happens when the testimony of your subjects gets dismissed? A few years ago I did a film in Mali about issues around land and food, and we were just totally demolished by the government, by even some other NGOs who simply said people we were talking to lied to us. Have you ever been lied to by a subject?
So in terms of personal safety, I think you just have to take the judgment, is it worth it as a story? I mean, there's certainly been times where I've said, you know, I'm not entirely comfortable to go and do this story because of the impact. It would not have just on me, but the people I was employing on the ground. I think there's the open filming of people where it's very clear that you're filming them, you sit down with them, you explain to them what the story is about, and make sure that they're not hesitant. There's only a certain level you can be persuasive, because I think, you know, I probably could persuade most people to do many things when it comes to TV, because there's a certain power you have when you have a camera, but I think you have to acknowledge that sometimes it may not be in their best interest. That's a judgment call at the time. Undercover work, I do a lot of blurring in a lot of my films, simply because you don't want anyone who is in the absolute centre appearing in it. To come on your point about have I been lied to? Well, obviously, the McAlpin case was a misunderstanding, but apart from that, no, I don't think anyone has lied to me, apart from governments. I mean, apart from people asking the right to respond.
It's a very interesting point. Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Lara White, my name is.
Lara, it's an interesting point Lara raises, that if somebody who, for instance, is a poor farmer or, you know, in a poor country, presents an argument, then a civil servant or a government minister can refute that with documentation, statistics, statements of policy, and so on. And it's, you know, it will inevitably want to carry more weight. The refutation, the denial will seem very powerful, won't it?
Well,
against anything that the wee guy can muster.
Yeah, we did a Newsnight investigation into DFID funding ending up in Ethiopia that was basically, what the consequence of that funding was, that we alleged, and I believe it was true, that money was being used for political purposes, and some villagers who were supporting the government were getting food aid, and if you said we will not support the government, you didn't get any DFID aid at all. So we went and we got proof and evidence and witnesses. And then 4 months later, the Ethiopian government came out with their own film, interviewed exactly the people we interviewed, and every single person said, looking rather terrified, no. We were very careful at the time to make sure that the people who were speaking knew that it was going to go out and knew that they could have had their doors knocked on. My thinking is, if somebody is well known enough, if somebody ends up on a BBC documentary, it hasn't happened to me, and it rarely happens, somebody goes and murders that person for speaking to the BBC, the hope is that the people who would murder are so fearful of your investigative journalism that they don't, because they know that you'll come back after them. That's the eternal promise. That's the only weapon you have, is that I will keep on back at you if you continue to do this.
I'm not going to rely on that.
No, possibly not.
Is television really the best medium of investigation? Yes, in the sense that you can get visual evidence of things, but no, perhaps in the sense that everything, the only thing that is on the record really is what is filmed, and people will be afraid.
Well, I mean, I did a big investigation with European structural funds being used for corruption throughout Europe. And we did a radio documentary, a TV documentary, and a lot of print. Mm-hmm. And in the areas where it was really complicated, the radio and TV aren't the easiest mediums to explain very complicated, in-depth analyses of certain budgetary lines, we kept that for print. And we kept the more flamboyant stories of how the mafia were kneecapping people in the south of Italy for not giving them contracts. We kept that for TV. And I think that this sort of multi-dimensional approach to journalism is a very useful one. Yeah. So it doesn't all have to reside, as it used to, in a 16-minute Newsnight special.
But also, when you were working with the BBC and you were given a story to follow, you described yourself as a human rights journalist, as you are now. But I'm sure a lot of your directors, a lot of the people over you in the BBC, they weren't primarily concerned about advancing human rights. They were interested in the story.
Absolutely.
And there would be elements of the story that would maybe not be great advertisements for human rights.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the challenge, and I was a commissioning editor for a while, and if somebody comes across too strongly as a human rights journalist...
You think he's not a journalist.
Exactly. Yeah. You pull back. So, whilst I was motivated by the desire to report on human rights, as I said, I was also much, you know, very happy to be pragmatic and report on straight news stories as well. Mm-hmm. I just felt that within the mix, there was always a balanced argument to include, you know, a story about torture, a story about something else.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I mean, I think I go back to this issue of scepticism. I mean, I've been incredibly sceptical, even if somebody is telling me that they've, you know, and very powerful, real tact is involved. Somebody's saying to you that somebody has raped them or somebody has murdered their children. And then you're saying, well, can you show me evidence that this has happened? Can I see the pictures of your children? Where were they buried? You have to ask these horrible, awkward questions. Otherwise, you just become a propagandist. And this is why I think, as I mentioned, the crucified Canadian soldier, is I'm very aware of the use of atrocities, yeah, both as propaganda or of reality.
Yeah, thanks,
Ben.
Yes, sir,
Julia. Hi, I'm a journalist, 30-odd years now. I edit for my sense a small online magazine called Beauty, Community Involvement Sector.
Yes, Brian.
Suppose for me, look, what you talk about, it's good range, your range, you know, it's to be looked up and envied, the stories you've done, the countries you've covered. But for me now, at the moment, as a journalist, and I still seem to have very much as a journalist, I'm always a bit sceptical of the term human rights investigative journalist. Mm-hmm. I just think investigative journalist on its own is a good enough label. Those things should be part of your moral compass, I think, in terms of what you're exploring. But for me, the big debate at the moment is, and can't be ignored, and shouldn't be ignored, is Gaza, mm-hmm, and how Gaza's being reported by the media. I mean, you know, it may move on to Ukraine after that, because that's, mm-hmm, that's a huge issue which is there. But at the moment, the world's tension, and there's a lot of debates. And in fact, here in Belfast, they have held pickets, such as the BBC, campaigning for their coverage. And I attended the last one, and I did. I felt somewhat uncomfortable because, on one hand, I think the BBC as an organisation, the way its construct of the coverage has been very poor and very bad. But as you said very earlier on your talk, a lot of the journalists are very good journalists, but they work for an organisation and there's values. Have you followed this debate? Do you have any views on it? Or, you know, what would you say about it?
I probably threw in the word human rights investigative journalism simply to cover the nature of the talk.
Yeah.
I would agree with you broadly that's an implicit suggestion. Of course, there's animal rights investigative journalism, but that's not massively interesting me. The issue of Gaza, I was in the occupied territories 2 weeks ago. I think the issue of the BBC's coverage of it, I think, is absolutely down to the nature of the very convoluted, very time-consuming Ofcom process, is that the friends of the State of Israel, the friends of Zionism, whatever the lobby groups, can put in 1,000 complaints to Ofcom every single time the BBC reports. The ex-editor of Panorama has told me that he is responding to Ofcom complaints as to Palestinian stories he's done 2 years before. And I think that somehow it almost becomes a sort of fear in the hearts of some editors, thinking, well, let's just make it as balanced as possible. Yesterday I tweeted, it was yesterday, that the front page of the BBC's website was led on the story, one Israeli soldier killed, or the lost Israeli soldier found dead. And I thought, you know, there's been 1,000 Palestinians killed.
So, I mean, there was a story the other day, for instance, although now we know the guy's dead, but that an Israeli soldier was abducted, you know, I mean, to use the term like abducted, describing a battlefield,
yeah,
you know, where you capture and take prisoners or execute or whatever. But abducted just seemed to be the wrong word.
Absolutely.
What was he doing? Going for his tea?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the intriguing element I'm not saying this is an excuse, it's just an observation, is that when you go to Israel, the Israelis can be incredibly charming, the Israeli Jews. And you can sit there and they can, for a moment, for a brief... I went to an anti-terror training camp 2 weeks ago in the heartlands of Palestine to interview this ultra-Zionist who had killed maybe 6 Palestinians with his bare hands, literally with his bare hands. And yet he was a brilliant PR man. He told a wonderful story. He kept on bringing up the Holocaust. And as a European with a conscience, you kind of go, well, I can't really talk about this. It's like talking to a black man in America about civil rights. You kind of go, okay, you're allowed to have that conversation. I will merely stand by. And I'll just say that when you're there, you can be seduced by their charmingness. And it's a beautiful country. Of course, then, then you separate in, like, a day before or a day after. I mean, I'd stood beside this 14-year-old boy who had been shot in the leg by an Israeli sniper for throwing a rock. And you think, in what country, I mean, if a 14-year-old had been killed by a soldier in any European country today, that would be front-page news. This boy, nobody had even reported the story. I was the only person to visit him in his hospital bed. And I think that there's a number of issues here. I was held up at Israeli airport for 7 hours trying to get into Israel. So there's an intimidation element, and you're always known that maybe we're not going to let you in next time. So that's one. There's a self-censorship. Happens in Thailand as well. People don't talk about the Laissez Majesté cases of people languishing in prison for 20 years for insulting the king because they don't want to be kicked out of Bangkok. I think the same may happen in Israel. But the other things, I think, is that you get seduced by the company of people. Most journalists end up going back to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. They don't, you know, file their stories. So you've got to go through the charming world of Israeli hospitality before you leave. These things are curious tensions in any reporting. And it's kind of hallucinatory. So you go to sort of the horrors of Palestine, and then you go back to the immense pleasures of Israel. And then you're sort of sitting there trying to write outrage. And it's kind of a weird disconnect. I'm just saying, I'm trying to be ultra distanced from my wide reporting is as it is.
Glenn, do you want to tell me?
Without philanthropy, I mean, is investigative journalism going to be very, very minimal in the UK?
That's an interesting point. I mean, we did have probably before your time, the glory days of Panorama and This Week, and you know, we had Thames Television and Investigations, which, you know, popularized more than anything.
Well, I mean, there was a kind of implicit point as to why I mentioned a couple of things. The shark calling thing, maybe it wasn't central to the debate, but what I was trying to say is that I think today, the old days of, you know, I'm going to get a job at a certain newspaper and I'll be paid throughout my life to be an investigative journalist, they're just not going to happen. So I think younger journalists now are going to have to think of, you know, as I do. I mean, I lecture in journalism, I write this book, I'm hired by a charity, and on top of that, I also try and get other funding to do specific projects. So I have four or five ways of trying to bring in income, and I think, in a way, investigative journalists have to be entrepreneurial and have to accept that, you know, they're constantly having to be looking for alternative sources of funding.
And yet, I mean, audiences won't be there for a lot of stuff. I mean, I've, for instance, done documentaries for Dispatches and Channel 4 about Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have your commissioning meeting, and it's always, well, we always expect the audience to drop off on Northern Ireland. They really don't want to know. And that must apply to a lot of other things. I'm sure it would be a lot easier, for instance, to sell a documentary on sex trafficking than on, I don't know, certainly Northern Ireland, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, and sometimes I think you have to be a little bit surreptitious.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is a flippant example, but I, as well as all the investigative journalism, simply as a jobbing, you know, having to pay the bills, I did some travel shows. And I once did a travel show in Cambodia, and it was a kind of a challenge show. And we had to challenge the person to do five different things, and we travelled all these countries. And I thought, look, I cannot do Cambodia without, in due conscience, doing something about the regime. But this was a travel show. So how do you put mass murder and genocide into this? So what I did is I got Miss Cambodia to dress up in a wedding dress, because that's what they wear in their displays, to go down to a local military range and fire an AK-47 to compete against my presenter. And then within that, I then explained the genocidal background to why AK-47s proliferated through Cambodia. So I think sometimes you have to be a little canny about how to tell the story, but I absolutely hear, you would look at the ratings disparity. I think something in the region of 12,000 people double-clicked on the Bureau story about Vodafone, and 96 million, 12,000, it's nothing. Yeah. And then I rather flippantly put up a story that Paul O'Grady's interview with Lady Gaga was sponsored by Yorkshire Tourism Bureau, and I couldn't quite work out how Lady Gaga... Anyway, it was stupid. I thought that got a cheat, and somebody retweeted and it got 1.6 million hits But you despair among us like that.
Can I come over here, Patrick, and just an end to Patrick? Sorry, yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Ryan. I want to ask about the Obama administration prosecuting journalists at the moment, like James Risen, and
are you cross-eyed?
In some cases investigating journalists, prosecuting them for not divulging their sources. Are you worried similar things might happen in the UK? And how should journalists respond to this so-called war on journalism?
I mean, I think the British parliamentarians are still, and rightly so, a bit scared of clamping down too much on journalists. So I don't really see a prosecution yet. I was genuinely concerned that I would be either arrested or kicked out of America after going back in there after having done the WikiLeaks. But again, I didn't find that. So. I think the deeper debate about protection of sources and covering your backside is an interesting one.
Well, for instance, you when you talked about the sex trafficking thing, you said that led to prosecutions.
Yeah.
Now, it's not your job to secure prosecutions.
No, not at all.
So how is that a happy outcome for a work of journalism?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a happy outcome, but I think it's just a quantifiable one. I mean, I could have quoted how many people watch the documentary. I mean, but there are really ethical moments you have in your... Like, for instance, I won't start saying too much about names, but I interviewed this young lad who we felt had been wrongly roughed up by the Scottish police following an accusation of murder, and that he had been forced to, as a strip search, not with a... He was 15, and a social worker wasn't present in the strip search, and he felt very upset by it. And I initially went to meet him to do a story about maybe this was a wrong thing. And I was sitting there and said, look, I have to discuss a little bit about this story with you. What sort of music do you like? I just want to get to know him. And he goes, I'm a really big fan of Marilyn Manson. I was like, fine. So I was writing down. And I said, well, do you mind showing me some of the CDs? Because I don't really know Marilyn Manson CDs. So he went up and he brought down a CD about something, The Dead Dahlia, I think it is, which is a murder that happened in New York, where a woman had her eyes gouged out in New York in the 1920s. And he showed me this cover, and it was a very, very powerful cover, not least because the girl that he was accused of murdering had her eyes gouged out. And so I sort of was looking at this thinking, this is a bit curious. And then I sort of started asking him about this girl. And he told me something that only somebody who had seen the body knew. And he had told the police he hadn't seen the body. And so I sort of sat there and went, I'm not entirely sure about you. And I was caught in this moral dilemma because he had told me something, not under any promises or anything, that I thought, actually, I might implicate you in the murder of this girl. It turns out that he was prosecuted, I was called as a central witness, and because I hadn't made him any promises, and I'm thankful I didn't, because had I said to him, this is just between you and me, then I would have had a problem.
Right, okay.
So luckily, I never... So my advice to my... I guess was never promise something you won't deliver on.
Yeah. Okay, so the source is not always a secret.
The British authorities have prosecuted journalists on textual sources. Yeah. We've had a number of cases here. Yeah. We actually had a BBC journalist who did 2 weeks in Crumlin Road jail on such, not giving up sources. Well, we had the Ed Maloney case and then several other prominent cases. Yeah. So it's not fair to say that parliamentarians, particularly British parliamentarians, are shy about prosecuting journalists in relation to particularly cases which is in their best interest to not have made public.
My background, as I'm sure, is sort of international exposés. So when it comes to local politics and local toes being trodden on, I'm sure there's a whole different ball.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks for clarifying that. I'm very conscious that Ian's been talking constantly now for an hour and a half, and I want to give him a break. But Patrick, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm sort of interested in somewhat amused, maybe because it's so cliche, that the Secret Services, you say, tried to recruit you when you were at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I'm doing a lot of work at the moment on the Concora scandal and pressing for that to be included in a sort of public inquiry to try and expose what we believe secret services covered up back in the 70s. I'm just wondering, in your work as journalists covering some of your stories, have you come across like the dark arts, or maybe even the invisible hand of the secret services or other branches of government that kind of stopped you exposing the truth and getting to the bottom of some of those stories?
When I was working on the WikiLeaks thing, a very curious thing happened. I got a text saying that I'm a source, I know what you're doing, I think we should meet, can you meet me at a certain location? I was like, who are you? He said, look, you'll find out when we meet, please arrange to meet. And it was an address in Brewer Street, I think, in Soho, number 24 or something. So I turned up at 24, and I was sort of waiting around texting him. And I didn't think anything of it, and nobody turned up. And then as I was leaving, I kind of looked around and realised number 24 was one of those model walk-up sections where a model on the outside, I mean, it was a brothel. And I thought, nothing happened of it, but I thought, I wonder if somebody's taking my picture just so that maybe they'll say, you know, release it. You know. I don't know. I mean, it just seemed very strange to me. And I never really explained that. So I went back and I wrote it, and I wrote up a report for the person who ran the bureau just to say this had happened. And I then, a few weeks later, and I wouldn't have normally said this about Brewer Street had not this happened. A few weeks later, somebody who was also at Cambridge with me, who said yes, I said no, to join the Secret Service. And he just knocked on my door. I hadn't seen him for years. And he said, like, I shouldn't be here, but I just want you to know that they're looking at you. And walked away. I was like, there in my dressing gown going, it's a very weird 6 a.m. meeting.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up. Sorry, Ken.
Well, it's in a related
Okay, quick thing. One. Yeah.
It is actually, you mentioned earlier about legislation. You mentioned security taking observation. One of the areas that's not often talked about is super injunctions, mm-hmm. because you can't talk about an individual injunction because it breaks the injunction. You can only talk about collective. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of super injunctions, not only in London, but particularly around senior figures here. Mm-hmm. But Leila Kunkora, again, hitting the headlines here, and new information about intelligence officers' involvement in it, and the inquiry about the kick-off in Westminster. Mm-hmm. Talking about Secret Service involvement in both. Where do you see the role of journalists in terms of covering that story, and what pressures do you think they're likely to face in light of the sort of revelations that are coming out? Again, if you've already put your own foot in it by getting it wrong, would you start?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, obviously there's a challenge with super injunctions about, you know, do you just go and break the law and do you get it out there? I mean, obviously Twitter is
it's the back door.
Is breaking new ways in.
Yeah.
And I think that there will be challenges about, you know, can you keep things silent going forward? Can things be kept quiet? Strangely, actually, for the McAlpine case, the reason, one of the problems I mean, I did a little bit of background research before I tweeted. I wasn't able to meet the two guys who my reporter had met, and I wasn't part of the editorial process of the BBC. But one thing I did do was obviously tweet, you know, email, Google, and do some searching about McAlpine. And the thing is, McAlpine had been mentioned numerous times for doing these acts, and he had never sued these other sort of underground publications for naming him. And that kind of, I guess, the fact that he hadn't used the libel laws made me think maybe there was something there. I think the there have been cases, obviously, when people have tried to get super injunctions imposed, and then the journalists have gone around it another way by his name, their person's name suddenly starts appearing, you know, next door to the super injunction report is mentioned, and then somebody else is, they're reported on a different story. You know, there are ways that things can be reported. But I think that the British legal system, as antiquated as it can be, will probably have to catch up, I think, to the evolution of digital media.
Look forward to that.
Anyway, thank you all very much for coming, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And I want to thank Ian for being so energetic and covering so much ground in such a short time.